Welcome to the Spoolcast. Ben Callahan joins Jared Spool in a discussion about responsive web design workflows. Ben will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the UX Immersion Conference April 7th through 9th in Denver, Colorado. For more information, visit uxim.co. That's uxim.co. And now, here's Jared.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Spoolcast. I'm Jared Spool, and we have today the great Ben Callahan from Sparkbox, who is at the UX Immersion Conference in Denver in April, going to be talking about workflow on responsive web design projects. And I'm very happy to be able to talk to him about some of the things behind responsive web workflow today. Ben, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jared. Thanks.
So you and I were talking before the show, and you mentioned this thing that when you're working on responsive design projects, all of a sudden at Sparkbox, you guys had to start changing your pricing. And it never occurred to me before that working on responsive stuff would actually get to the core of how we price and plan our projects. Everything changes now, doesn't it?
Yeah, man, it's been a really interesting journey for us because when we started, we were very linear in the way that we operated. We did a lot of fixed bid work, as many folks still do. No problem with that. But what we've found is as our development and design process has gotten more and more collaborative, more and more iterative, it's had this sort of ripple effect on all the other parts of what we do. And that's everything from the way that we manage projects, the way that we help set client expectations, the way that we price our projects. And in fact, we've shifted, as you were kind of implying there, Jared, we've shifted to working in a completely hourly model now. You know, for us, that's been mostly about really just keeping everybody, including our customers, very, very involved in the project and giving them the ability to shift priority as is really needed and sometimes even required by the business that they run. So it's really just about being very easy to work with as much as it is about helping the expectation and the education and collaboration of a project be successful.
So an hourly model, I mean, that sort of implies that you're not as comfortable saying what the total scope is going to be at the very beginning. That implies that it's a much more iterative, organic, evolutionary. I got that implication, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, what's funny is what we'll do often now is, and I think Matt Griffin wrote about this recently, but it's something that he and I have talked a lot about and we've started doing quite a bit, is instead of trying to gather all the requirements up front and spend a ton of time, you know, trying to get everything just right and documenting and then putting a price on it, what we end up doing is we'll get a statement of work with a customer that will be for 20, 40 hours, something like that. And then we'll sit down with them for, you know, a couple days, go to their office or whatever, meet with them, do some Skype calls, and just try to get a feel for if we're going to be a good fit even for the project. And we'll spend that little bit of time together with them, giving them an opportunity to meet us and vice versa. And then we'll write up what we think is a good approach, a recommendation for how a project might be phased and scoped. But really with the understanding, and my technical director, Rob Harsh, says this all the time, the understanding that we know less about your project today than we will tomorrow. And we want to embrace that idea instead of pretend like it's not true. And so for us, it's really about just whatever we can learn, we want to inform what we do next. And that's how our pricing happens. That's how our project management happens. That's how everything now is working for us.
Is this just sort of less about responsive and more just an admission that this has always sort of been the way, but now that we're talking responsive, we sort of have an excuse to be able to say to the client, we don't really know as much about your project as we're going to once we get into it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really valid point. I feel like a lot of the stuff that I'm, I guess, relearning as I do this stuff longer, I feel like it's kind of that way, you know. And, you know, we talked about this, you know, collective hallucination that we all participated in with the idea that the web is fixed width. The same thing's true with a lot of other things. Our linear process is, you know, we kind of made it work. But in the end, there's so many holes in those ideas. And so for us, I guess I've just settled on the fact that everything is up for grabs at this point, you know? And so we're willing to change, and we are constantly changing how we work, you know? So if you were to ask me again in a week, I might have a different idea for you, but we're just constantly changing, you know, and trying to find an efficiency where we can. And so this is one that I think has been hugely helpful for our customers and for us, honestly.
And you've been successful at it.
I would absolutely say that we definitely have. When we shifted to doing more responsive work, or really it's just about building this level of flexibility into what we do. When we started doing that more, we just found that there were so many things, so many factors involved. And to try and quantify all those and, you know, get ahead of and understand and account for it in the numbers of an estimate was just incredibly difficult. Not that you can't do it, but it takes so much time up front. And in the end, what we all know is that projects change. We could spend, you know, we try to keep our project duration short as well so that we can do, you know, phases of a project. But if I plan out a 3-month project, for me to think that my client's business isn't going to change in, you know, from day one till the end of that project, it's just not true. And so what we've talked about is trying to find a way that we can adjust our model of pricing and how we operate so that we don't punish our clients for their business changing, because that's just a reality today, you know? So that's kind of, I guess, some of the thinking that's pushed us in this direction.
So I'm sure you must have stakeholders and clients who are really anxious about hitting a deadline or getting things done with a certain amount of budget. How do you make sure you get to a completion point that gets them happy without knowing offhand what the full scope of the project's going to be?
This is the question that I always get. And it's not just from other folks in the industry, but obviously from every customer that we talk to. So a lot of times, and I'll just kind of explain here, you know, kind of how exactly this ends up playing out for us. So a lot of times when we were doing fixed bid pricing, you know, a customer was committing to us for the duration of a project. So maybe let's just say it's a 3-month project and it's 50 grand, something like that, right? So we've got some duration. We would look at that and we would say, let's do, you know, 3 payments. We'll do a third up front. We'll do a third when we're halfway through, and we'll do a third at the very end, you know? And so we would structure something kind of like that. And there's contracts that are signed in that scenario that kind of commit both parties to doing all the stuff, you know, and making those payments. And what we found is that in order for us to request the kind of flexibility in pricing that we want, we also have to give a little bit in terms of the flexibility for that contract. So what that means is that we don't ask somebody to sign a long-term contract for us. So in that same scenario, we would certainly put some thought behind, you know, approximations of what the budget should be. And we may come up with a very similar number, but it's all with the understanding that it's an estimate. You know, we're doing our best guess here. And then what happens is, if we don't do our job, if our customers aren't happy with what we've delivered, they absolutely have the ability to walk away. And everything that we've done up to that point is theirs. And that understanding means that for us, we're basically sharing the risk of the project with our customers. Instead of committing to some number and then seeing scope change and dealing with all the struggles that come along with that kind of management, where there's change requests and just constant dialogue about that, what we've found is if we don't do our job, we lose it. And so we have to make our customers happy. We have to show that, you know, we're delivering value for the price they're paying. Now, I will also say that for us, we adjust our hourly rate to make sure that, you know, we're in line with what will allow us to deliver a really high quality project, you know, for a price. In the end, what happens is this becomes a very constant conversation with our customers. It opens up the conversation about money. And so we find ourselves literally every week talking with our customers about, hey, you know, we've spent 60 hours so far on this. That's about where we think we should be. But also it's possible that, hey, you know, we're a little behind, honestly. And so what we'd like to do is get into a little bit more depth of conversation around the priorities that you have. And let's get those literally listed, you know, first priority to the last priority, and recognize that we may not get all the way through this list. And if something's going to get cut, what should it be? It puts those decisions in our customers' hands and allows them to sort of prioritize exactly what we work on, obviously with our recommendations for what would be a valid delivery. But we get to work with them on it, I guess, is the point. And that's created much better, much stronger, longer lasting relationships with our clients.
So a lot of this came about because you started doing responsive. What was it about responsive design that caused this shift in how you had to interact with the people you're doing these projects for?
That's a good question. You know, I've spent some time thinking about that because it's not just pricing. You know, literally this has impacted everything that we've done in the entire way that we operate. I mean, we've changed the layout of our office, you know, to adjust for this. And for us, you know, I think you were right, you know, that responsive isn't necessarily the reason, probably. It's really more just coming to terms with reality. But for us, really, the level of flexibility that we have to build for. Doing a design, like just a visual UI design, is so much more complex now, because where we used to participate in that sort of myth, you know, that there was a 1,000 pixel wide browser that was just always going to be visiting our sites, that's just not the truth. And so now we think about the idea that a UI, a design, has to work from 200 pixels to 2,000 pixels. What's the design deliverable in that world? You know, that messes with your head a little bit when you're used to just delivering Photoshop files and everybody approving and then moving on. So, you know, for us, it started by impacting how we work. And then it from there grew and spread into the idea that, well, maybe how we bill should change too. And that means maybe the structure of our estimates needs to change. And that means how we manage the expectations of our clients needs to change. So it's really been sort of a rippling effect for us. And the example of a UI design is just one of many, you know, in the production work that we do every day. So
how much of this is the content? Most of the time, I'm guessing, when you're working with your clients, they're producing the content. You're not producing it in-house or working with some third-party content production service that they've hired. Is that true? Or
for some of the projects, that's true. We have a content strategist on our team, Emily Gray, who's fantastic at what she does. And, you know, part of her job, actually, a lot of the same conversations we were just having around pricing and the idea that you give your customers the ability to prioritize the stuff that you work on with your expertise and recommendations, obviously. But we take that same approach with content. And we believe that it's really difficult to do effective UX and UI and development without an understanding of the content that we're going to be building for. So we try to do that as early in the process as we can. But it really also is about priority, you know. And I think Stephen Hay, and in a lot of his work, when he talks about workflow and responsive, is he talks about this idea of designing with text. And we believe in that wholeheartedly, you know. And we start with that simplistic view of what we're building. And it's really at that point about priority. We keep things very linear. And we try to get a really good understanding of the content that's required and the content types. And we get those things prioritized and we put them together in scenarios where they're going to be, you know, experienced for our users. And we try to make sure that, you know, we're establishing priority effectively. One thing we've seen is as you lose screen real estate, so as you shift from an expectation that your larger screen is the default to an expectation like Luke Rabluski talks about where, you know, your small screen is your default, as you shift down to that thinking about a smaller screen as your default experience, we've seen that you lose different ways to prioritize. So the tools that a designer might use to communicate priority are reduced as the amount of viewport available is reduced. And that means you really do have to have a very clearly defined understanding of the priority of your content and your functionality. So for us, it has to start there, you know.
So how has this designing with text sort of changed the way you guys do your work?
Let's see. You know, I think it really still kind of comes back to the idea of priority. Designing with text for us, and we talk about content priority guides and content prototypes, those kinds of things are the sorts of stuff that we're actually doing. We try to do as much of that in HTML as we can, but even before that, just a simple doc that shows the content types. But for us, what's happened is we start to think in an incredibly linear way. So we might say that we know there's a series of pages in our system that are required for communication of a certain kind of content. And when we look at those, we get all that content together, identify the content types, and we get them onto a page. And then we can start moving things around with our customers', you know, feedback. And really, it's linear. So literally, you force people to pick a number one priority. And we move that to the top, and it's just top to bottom importance, you know. And then we shift that very quickly into just static HTML. And our content people write markup for us. I mean, you've heard the conversation going around, obviously, that if you're going to be a designer on the web, you need to learn to write code. We think that that's true for content people, too. You know, if you're going to work in content on the web, you should learn some HTML. It's really not that difficult. You know, HTML, honestly, a purely sort of semantic approach to it is not that complex. There's a handful of elements. And who better to generate clean, simple, semantic markup than the person who best understands the content. So we shift that role of writing a first round of markup to our UX and our content people. And that helps us, instead of doing writing markup in CSS based on some Photoshop picture, we're writing it based on a solid understanding of the priority. And that's really what we should do. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that we would just take that pristine, perfectly semantic markup and that's all we'll ever do with HTML, because, you know, I've worked on enough systems and understand that a large system requires a level of modularity to be maintainable. And there's all these kinds of things that impact the markup. But I want to start with the ideal, you know, and I think that the content and UX people are the best ones to give us that ideal, that purely semantic HTML. So then the rest of our team can take that work and just continue to evolve it in the medium we're going to deliver in the browser, you know.
It's interesting to me that you're teaching the content people to actually do markup, because in fact, you know, when I started in publishing, you did that anyways, right? You bolded the things you wanted bolded and you italicized the things you wanted italicized. And that's really just applying markup in its simplest form. And you know what you want to be a header. And I know the shock that authors have when they look at their text and the markup is wrong and they go, why would you do it that way? I don't understand. And so I bet that the authors like having some control over the semantics in the markup. It allows them to emphasize the right things.
Absolutely. And one trick that I've learned is just in some previous experience teaching basic HTML to young folks who want to learn how to build for the web, one thing that I've learned over time that's an effective tool for teaching this stuff is to kind of slip a little reset style sheet in when people are writing their very first, you know, HTML page. And what that does is it strips out, you know, I mean, HTML doesn't have style applied at all, right? So the browsers that we use actually have their own little style sheets that they apply, that apply default styling. That's what you and I see when you type an H1 and with no CSS and it looks like it's big and bold, you know? The browsers do that for us. So what I've learned is if I slip a little reset style sheet in, that just normalizes everything. So everything just looks like text, period, whether it's a H1, a paragraph, a link, anything. Just remove all style. If I do that, it helps people to really understand that all they're doing is writing content, but they're adding semantic meaning. They're not adding design, you know. And we may take that, the implied meaning that's added to, you know, that's marked into the markup itself, and enhance it visually in some way to help communicate the kinds of meaning that is being implied. But I love the idea of separating that early in the process. But I think it has to be done in balance with an understanding that the systems that we build have to be maintainable. And so we find ourselves now, we actually had Jonathan Snook come to our office and, you know, he spent a day with my front end devs just explaining his system for building, you know, maintainable large scale CSS. And it's really, it was a whole conversation about how do I pick class names? That was the whole day, you know, but it's really important stuff if you want to build something that's maintainable. And so I understand that in the end, it's almost impossible to deliver purely semantic HTML with no connection to the style. We still have to bake that in, but I want to do that after I've taken that idealistic approach. So that's my personal opinion, at least.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. So now the way you guys are working this stuff, how many designers do you have and how many developers do you have at Sparkbox there?
Okay, I'll give you some numbers here. We're a strange shop, though. I'll tell you that before I say this. I don't know a lot of organizations that are structured like we are, and we just have tried to find something that works for us. So we have, I think there's 19 of us total in the office now. We have a couple admin staff, and then we have a technical director, Rob Haar, a creative director, Jeremy Lloyd, a UX director, and a content strategy director. And then we have a team of basically front-end developers and back-end developers. And so most of our people are front-end and back-end devs. You'll notice we don't have any person who is just a standard designer, a UI designer. Jeremy is our creative director, Jeremy Lloyd, and he essentially sets the creative direction for every project that we do. And all we do all day long is build responsive web stuff. So he's got his hands full. But what we've found is that by bringing in front-end developers who are actually probably could be designers in their own right, but their choice, their medium where they are fluent most is in HTML and CSS. By having those people on our team, we're able to just do enough design that we communicate the direction. And then sort of entrust the rest of that to our front-end devs. And then they'll work very, very closely with Jeremy, the creative director, and we call this scenario sort of a design pairing situation. But Jeremy will literally sit with them, you know, for a couple hours each week, just making sure that the direction they're carrying his vision out is the direction he really had envisioned for the project. And so, honestly, most of the time if you walk into our office, it's half the computers have somebody sitting at them and the other half have two people at them. And that just tends to be how we work a lot, is there's a lot of collaboration. Whether that's a content strategist and a back-end dev sitting together to figure out how a content management system should be structured, or whether it's this design pairing kind of idea where our creative director is sitting with a front-end dev just, you know, tweaking, you know, the details that are so critical to a good project.
I like this. This is very cool. And I think even though you sort of disclaimed it at the beginning, from an agency perspective, it may not be that common. But I think the ratio that you're talking about is extremely common for folks who work internally to organizations. It's not unusual to have 20 developers for every designer.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And it seems to me that this idea of entrusting and pairing is really an important one. How did you guys figure out how to make that work?
Boy, man, I think it's really just been trial and error for us. You know, I think in the end, what I've realized about it is it's less about how you do it and it's more about who you have on your team. You know, we talk about this idea that the kinds of people we want at Sparkbox are people who have a level of humility that allows them to work with each other and not expect that their idea is always going to be the best one. You know, people who are willing to hear other people's critique, but also to offer critique in a way that it can be received. We talk about this idea of expertise. You know, they have to have a great amount of fluency in the tools that we expect them to use. And those two are actually, honestly, very often in opposition to each other. Finding people who are really good at something, but also very humble, that's a difficult find. But then we talk about this other idea, and I know I'm sure you have a lot of UX folks who listen to the Spoolcast here. We talk about this idea of empathy a lot, and I've heard it used extensively in regards to UX and, you know, gaining empathy for our users. And I absolutely believe in that. But I also love the idea that we might find a way to have empathy for our peers, you know, on our teams. And I think that that's partly what's required here too. Just in the end, you know, we have to make decisions that are going to be for the good of the project, not for the good of ourselves as individuals. And sometimes that means putting others ahead of yourself. Sometimes that means, you know, sticking up for the thing that you really believe is the best decision for the project. But without an understanding of what the others on your team are going through, it's really hard to have the clarity that's needed, you know, to make really good decisions for the project.
And so when you guys are doing this pairing thing, Jeremy's actually sitting at the same desk, right?
Yeah, one computer, two people. Again, especially for a designer, it can be really intimidating to have a bunch of people crowded around their system telling them to move pixels around and whatnot. The same is true for a front-end dev, you know? So it really does require patience with each other. And what we've found, though, and I think everybody on my team, I think, would agree with this, it's that the work is better, you know? And so everybody who's in this industry wants to create fantastic, beautiful things. And this helps us do that, you know? And if you read about pairing in the development world, you know, there's tons of people who have written about this, and it's become a very common practice. It's a lot of people hesitate to do it because they think, well, if I'm going to have two people do one project, that means it's going to cost me twice as much. But what we've found is that our productivity is higher, because people aren't sitting, you know, by themselves with the temptation to go check Twitter all the time. They're sitting with somebody, you know, they're not going to be constantly flipping to email or Twitter or something like that. But they're also, you know, with somebody who's broadening their skill set, you know, for a front-end dev to sit and hear how our creative director Jeremy talks about typography. That's really important for those front-end devs. And the next time that they take one of his style prototypes or something and begin to evolve it into a set of templates, they're going to make better decisions because they've sat with him in the past and understood his thinking. So it's this cross-pollination, and in the end, it brings the quality of everyone. Everybody's skill set gets increased because we do it, you know. It's really been invaluable to us.
It sounds like there's a lot of design literacy that's coming out of that, that a lot of what you're doing here, you know, educating the client about the scope of the project and how things are going to change, educating the content people to be able to think semantically and to put the semantic markup into the work they do so that that's easier to translate and style, and then working with the developers to make sure that they know more about design and understand the rationale and the thinking and the theory behind what's happening, and not just trying to work off a blueprint and hope that when they have to make a decision, they've decided the right thing on their own. It feels to me like what you're doing is you're creating a team that's with your internal folks and your clients that are more literate about the design that they're producing and more capable of then, when they are by themselves making a decision because a decision has to be made to move forward, the decision's more likely to be one that's going to fit the mold of what you're trying to do.
You nailed it, Jared. That's exactly what we're looking for is, you know, we talk about, and we're not the ones who came up with this idea, but I'm sure you've heard of the idea of a T-shaped person, you know, someone who has great depth of expertise in a certain area and brings that to the table, but they also have, you know, the top bar of a T, right? They have a lot of breadth of expertise too. And a lot of folks come to an organization expecting that they need to be an expert in one thing. But what we found is that the way that at least that we work, and that I think a lot of shops are shifting towards on the web, is the level of flexibility we have to build for means that everybody on the team has to have some understanding of all the disciplines. And that helps with the empathy that I talked about. That helps with the humility. It just, in general, makes the team better. So, in fact, one other little insight. We love this idea of learning that you were talking about. And we do the workshops. You know, we travel around. We do workshops. We speak a lot. I require all of our people to write. Most people, when they start, don't feel like they have a lot to offer. But what we've tried to communicate is that you just write about what you're learning. You know, there's so many people who are just a step behind you, and there's a lot of people who are a couple steps before you, and just find your place in that scale and work to try and communicate what you're learning. And that's all we need to do. We want that documented. We want to help if we can in the industry in that way. But we also, we bring in really young folks in as apprentices, and we do that for a 6-month apprenticeship that's a paid apprenticeship. And it's great that we get to do that. We work with these young folks to teach them how to do the stuff we do. But in the end, for me, what's the most valuable part about that apprenticeship is that I give my team an opportunity to teach as well. And they'll sit with these young students who are asking these fantastic questions and challenging my team on why they chose to do something a certain way. Really honestly, with a level of innocence that's just, you know, really kind of humbling sometimes. And so when those questions come, the next time that person has to go work with an apprentice, they realize, yeah, I've got to know my crap. You know, I got to put this stuff together in a way that I can actually defend what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. And it happens that, you know, a young person will ask a question that pokes a hole in something we're doing. You know, they're looking at it with a different perspective. And that's an opportunity for us to improve our efficiency, to improve our workflow, to find a better way, you know? So I love that stuff. That stuff is inspiring to me. And in the end, I think it just helps everybody, you know?
Yeah, you don't really learn something, truly learn it, until you teach it to someone else.
Absolutely true.
Okay. Well, Ben, this has been absolutely fascinating. I cannot wait to get to your workshop. For those of you who are thinking about this, this is going to be at the UX Immersion Conference. It's a full conference that's talking about all things mobile. There's a lot of discussion about responsive design, and Ben's going to do a full day workshop on workflow about responsive design web projects. And it's going to be a lot of fun, and I'm really excited about it. And it's going to be April 7th in Denver. It's all day. It's part of a 3-day conference that goes from the 7th to the 9th. And you can find more information about it at uxim.co. That's where we talk about the conference. And it's going to be fun. Ben, it's going to be great to see you in Denver.
I'm so excited, man. I really am. It's going to be a blast.
Cool. So thank you again for coming and making us so much smarter today. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
And I want to thank our audience. You know, if you listen to this on the iTunes, could you do me a favor? Could you go and take a moment and put in a little review for us? Tell us what you think, because that's how we keep track of it. Look at those things and other people look at them, and it's really helpful. Just take a second to do that. That would be awesome. And once you've done that, again, I want to thank you for spending the time. And as always, thank you for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you next time. Take care. Thank you.
more information about the UX Immersion Mobile Conference in Denver, Colorado, April 7th through 9th, visit uxim.co. That's uxim.co. As always, thank you for listening.